Happy New Year. It is my custom to give to have the first talk of the year be on the Four Noble Truths. So this will be the first talk of the year. And the Four Noble Truths is sometimes seen as the kind of the key or central teaching of the Buddha, that everything else kind of radiates out from there. And in introductory books to Buddhism sometimes, or introductory classes, the Four Noble Truths are often introduced first, right away. And the idea is very simple. And I think it's pretty easily understandable, at least the principle. Whether you agree with it or not, that's another question, but it's very simple. But it seems that when the Buddha taught what he had to teach, he didn't treat the Four Noble Truths as the entry point for people into his teachings and practice. Meaning that if the Buddha was going to teach a, you know, introductory course in Buddhism to people who didn't know anything, he would not start with the Four Noble Truths. And actually he would wait a long time until he felt that the audience had a sufficient enough spiritual maturity, had enough clarity of mind, had the mind which was stable and calm enough to be able to understand the full import of the Four Noble Truths. And you see this kind of idea in the famous text that is the foundation for our practice, the mindfulness practice, the teachings, the sutra, the discourse the Buddha gave called the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, that we describe practice of mindfulness. And he gives a series of ways of practicing mindfulness in this text. And the very last teaching there, last practice given, is the practice of the Four Noble Truths. Now that's significant in two ways. One is, again, you see it comes last. And all the earlier parts of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, where you develop mindfulness of the breath, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of the mind, are the foundation that allows a person to apply or use the Four Noble Truths in a deep way. And when people came to the Buddha who didn't know anything about his teaching, and maybe didn't know much about spiritual life at all, he wouldn't teach them the Four Noble Truths, but he would teach them first about the importance of generosity. And he'd teach them the practice of generosity. And then he would teach them the practice of virtue, help them develop their virtue. And the idea is you develop these wonderful qualities of generosity, of virtue first. And not just because they're good qualities to have, but also in developing them, it gladdens the mind. That's a theory, at least. That's the Buddha thought. I don't know how it is for you. But it's supposed to kind of gladden the mind, kind of make the mind happier. And a happier mind, a happy mind, is the kind of mind that you want to teach the Four Noble Truths to. And it seems maybe a little bit counterintuitive, because you would think that if people are suffering a lot, that maybe you would introduce them the Four Noble Truths right away, because the Four Noble Truths are really about kind of a very direct pointing to the cause of suffering. So if there are people who are suffering, you should just kind of hold a mirror up to the cause, the origins of their suffering and the possibility of freeing it right away and help them. And maybe that's a works for some people, but I think maybe some people for whom are very depressed or upset or really afraid or somehow tormented or troubled in some way, maybe it's more useful to teach other things first. Help them to cultivate a certain kind of gladness and happiness in their lives before you actually help them address the suffering directly. And so I leave that for you to kind of just ponder, think about. There's a story in China, Chinese Buddhist story, of I think it was like a general, some general or governor of a province, who went to visit a monk who was called something like the tree monk, because he lived in a tree all the time. He spent his whole time living up in a tree. And it's kind of a little odd thing to do, but it was his thing to do. And he went to visit this tree monk, and he asked him what the teachings of the Buddha are. And the monk, looking down at him, said, told him the Four Noble Truths. And the governor said, "Oh, any child knows that." And the tree monk says, "Yes, but even a person who's 90 may not have really realized these four truths." So there's a difference between understanding them and realizing them. Now, the Four Noble Truths, I realize for those of you who might be new to all this, I still haven't defined them. But the Four Noble Truths are usually, again, in introductory books in Buddhism, offered as the central teaching of Buddhism. And for some Western people, they translate that to being the creed of Buddhism. This is, you know, if you really understand what the teachings of Buddhism is, you understand the Four Noble Truths. As far as I can tell, the Buddha did not offer the Four Noble Truths as a belief, as a teaching in that kind of way that's a creed or belief. What he did, the Four Noble Truths, even the word Four Noble Truths frightens some people in the West, or truth, you know. And usually when you spell do it in English, you have it in capital T, the Four Noble Truths. Oh, it's really big. And it's a truth. A truth is a proposition. And so this is a proposition about reality, you know, the truth. However, when the Buddha introduced the Four Noble Truths, he didn't introduce them as teachings that way, as abstractions or principles. He introduced them as practices, things that you have to engage with and use, do certain things with. And the tradition talks about each of the Noble Truth has a duty or a task connected to it. So it's a task that's important, not the, you know, believing it in some kind of way. Oh, now I understand what Buddhism is about. It's to take each of these truths and apply the task that each implies, or each points to in our lives. So the task of the First Noble Truth is to comprehend or understand suffering. So that's the task, to really understand it well. And I was reminded this last week of a famous Ajahn Chah quote teaching, where he said, "Those who run from suffering run right into it." So be careful. So here the idea is you study it, Now, someone who's new to all this and is depressed and anxious and all that, maybe it's the wrong thing to tell them to study their suffering. Maybe they should wait for quite a while before they're ready. But at some point, understanding suffering is the key, one of the key aspects of Buddhist practice. There's an understanding that goes, that's part of it. The second task, and the second noble truth, is to abandon something, let go of something. And that abandoning, that letting go of, is the letting go of the cause of suffering. The origins, what prompts the suffering to happen. Suffering doesn't arise without a cause. And so we need to understand that cause, and then we need to abandon or let go of that cause. And the cause is said to be craving or grasping or thirst, or I like the word drivenness or compulsion. If there is compulsivity in the mind, you're not free. And meditators will realize this very quickly, because if you try to meditate and you say, okay, I'm going to just sit down, place my breath on the mind, or place my breath, my mind in the present moment, and I'll just stay there. That's what I want to do. It's my desire, it's my wish, it's my intention, it's the direction I give my mind. You know, and you sit down, you do it, put great determination, you put your attention on the breath. And how long does it last? You could be, you know, have tremendous passion, wonderful spiritual passion for practice. You feel like the most important thing in the world for you. Nothing else is more important. And you, with all that passion, you sit down and follow your breath. Well, in that case, maybe you get 4 seconds. And what you'll find out is the mind has a mind of its own very quickly. And the mind is running around this way and that way. And your choice, you know, you don't seem to have much choice of what the mind does, where it goes. And some of that you can see is kind of drivenness or compulsivity of the mind, where the mind takes over. And you can, if you watch, you see how much the mind kind of carries you around, pushes you around. You're sitting quietly and you get caught up in a fantastic desire, a fantasy of desire. And sometimes it's very hard to extract yourself from it. Or you get filled with anger about someone or something. And it's very hard. You can just say, okay, that's enough, thank you. You know, I think I'll do something better now, more interesting. And the mind doesn't want to let go that easily. Because it's kind of pushing you. Just, you know, keep thinking about that. Keep being angry, or keep being desirous, or keep being afraid, or keep planning, or whatever it might be. So the recognition in Buddhism is that there's a very strong addictive quality in the mind, or compulsive quality in the mind. And when the mind is involved in compulsivity, then you can say to that degree, the mind is not free. But more important in this teaching of the Buddha, when the mind is in this compulsivity mode, that's the origin, or that's the source that gives birth to suffering. So, to somehow learn to let go of the drivenness of the mind, of any kind at all. So, that's the second task, is to let go. And the third task is to realize, and the word realize is very important in Buddhism, to realize something, to realize the truth. And so to realize the cessation of suffering, to see its ending, to really see it. And this is 3 very important steps. So it involves some understanding. So the idea of understanding, knowledge, understanding is a very important one in Buddhism, in Buddhist spirituality. You're not supposed to get liberated without also understanding what goes into it. How you get yourself liberated. What are some of the forces in the mind that are operating that need to be addressed, that need to be dealt with in order to get liberated? So to have someone pass a magic wand over you and say abracadabra, and you're now liberated. Now that could be very pleasant and very nice, and you think it could be quite efficient that way. But this is not how the Buddha taught. The Buddha said you have to actually understand this whole process, how it works. So there's some work involved. There is a, there's a There's work. There's some, and I like it. There's some work. It's kind of, it involves a certain level of spirit of, I think, maturity of self-understanding to really engage and look and understand what is really going on in this world of mine, in my mind, and then in that deep understanding, then finding liberation. So then realizing the cessation of suffering. And then because letting go of clinging and realizing the end of suffering, the cessation of suffering, is not an easy task, then the fourth noble truth is something that is the truth. The task there is to cultivate oneself, to develop oneself. So the human mind and heart is quite malleable, and it's a malleability that we can somehow take responsibility for. If we don't take responsibility for the processes of our mind, the directions of our mind, the intentions, the feelings, the thoughts, the impulses of the mind, there are lots of people in society who will do it for you. And I'm really deeply impressed by how easy it is to be conditioned by our friends, by our society, by our media, by all kinds of things, by our politicians. And you have to be very, very sensitive to the impulses that come in from our society to somehow be able to withstand the deep, deep conditioning, the way we're conditioned by what goes on. And so in Buddhism, we're not letting the mind be developed and changed and shaped by forces outside of us, but rather there's a dedication to take some kind of responsibility for the shaping of the mind. The mind's always being shaped. In Buddhism, the idea is the mind is not a thing. So it was a thing, and then you can kind of just maybe just, you can just have it made, you're set. But the mind is a series of processes, and those processes are constantly changing and flowing. And if you think of, some of you have been to Spirit Rock, and you know, there's a wonderful creek that goes, I was at Spirit Rock this last week in the meditation center up in Marin County, where in the epicenter of the rainstorms. And we were kind of in a steep hill, so it's, you know, the rain just mostly just washed away, but there's this creek that runs by the meditation center, by the kitchen all there. And we woke up, I guess Saturday morning, was it, to the road from the kitchen all the way down to the lower parking lot looked like a, what did it look like? It was completely filled, strewn with trees and logs and stumps, and it was really dramatic. And then the whole creek that goes up by the meditation center had not radically changed its contours and shape, but it had been re-landscaped. And you know, if you've been used to walking along there, it's, you know, have your favorite meditation spot, you know, in the shade of some big tree. Well, the rock's not there. The boulder you sat on is no longer there. The, you know, the trees are no longer there. Now you'd be sitting in the sun if it's sunny. You know, it's all been re-landscaped. So, you know, nature's processes, it's always being changed and shaped. And it's not a thing. Jack Kornfield learned that because he, when they first got Spirit Rock, the idea that he would go, and he actually went with some people and went down to the creek and was shaping the creek and making, I don't know what he started doing, little places to sit and whatever, and to make it really idyllic and nice. And someone told him, Jack, don't, you know, it doesn't work this way. And so the mind is that way too. The mind is something constantly being shaped by forces. And so it takes a certain degree of sensitivity to be able to understand that and understand how the impulses affect us and take some responsibility for it. So these four tasks then, to understand something, which is understand suffering, which requires studying it, letting go of something, realizing something, and then cultivating something, developing the mind. And again, this is something to be meant to be done by people who are already somewhat spiritually developed already. And so you have to already have that, a trained mind, a calm mind, in order to do this work. And so if you feel exhausted just listening to me, all the stuff these Buddhists, they're always telling me what things I have to do. This is actually supposed to be, one understanding, that this is actually something you do when your mind is actually quite stable and deep and concentrated. And it's easy to do it then. Relatively easy. It doesn't feel like work. So in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, this famous discourse, it kind of ends with Buddha offering the Four Noble Truths. And I'd like to tell you how it begins, because I think it has a very interesting beginning. When the Buddha gets ready, when he's going to start teaching the spiritual practice of mindfulness, he begins, like every sentence, I guess, he begins with a single word, one word. And that word, when I realized recently what that word is in this text, that first word, I was really struck by it. It really resonated deeply for me. And we just skip over that first word. No one pays attention to it. The first word in the instruction. And so the word in Pali, the Buddhist language, is ida. So. And it's a nice word. And it reminded me of the opening of the rules of Saint Benedict, Benedictine order, and it starts with it's probably Latin or Italian or Latin, the word ascolta. Ascolta. So it's the first word. Ascolta means listen. And when I was introduced to this as the rules of Saint Benedict, that first word is considered very significant. It's very deep spiritual significance, listening, ascolta. So, for us Buddhists, we have this very important word, ida. And then I thought, oh, that's a great word, ida. It's one of those great words that ends with ah. It's just a relief. These great spiritual realities and spiritual truths that have these wonderful words when ah. Then you can relax. Allah. It's a great word, right? Or Rama, or Jehovah, or Krishna. So we have Ida, the Buddhists. Isn't that great? Isn't it good to have a word like that? A word that, is really important. Kind of points to maybe what's most sacred for Buddhists, the place of the thing is a kind of spiritual refuge, spiritual solace, spiritual, the ground of spiritual life, where it's all found. It's good we have such a place, isn't it? Really good. Like every religion should have this, right? So we have Ida. So you're probably getting angry with me now. I'm not telling. You got our attention. Why didn't you just tell us? Ida. So it means here. Like here and now here. Here. That's our God here. And that's the place it all begins. And that's the, you know, a refuge, or that's the place of practice or realization here. That's so important for Buddhists. Here. So here. Here we are. So, first task is to be here. Not to be someplace else with the mind. Doesn't mean you have to be at IMC, but I mean here. You know, here where you are, wherever you are, to really be here. And if you study the mind, you find that it's very easy for the mind, for your body to be in one place and your mind to be someplace else. You're thinking about the future, thinking about the past, thinking about fantasy someplace that has to do with someplace else or something. But to actually really be here is the first task of practice, mindfulness practice. And there's something really precious about here. To some degree, for most of us, here is pretty safe. It's a pretty safe place to be. For most of us, our anxieties, our fears, our distresses, that we many in our modern life, the way we live, much of our stress and anxiety and suffering is often not about something that's right here. But rather, to some degree, it's imaginary. Not to discount it, that it's not, has some reality to it, but it's like in the future, perhaps. People think a lot of, anxious about the future. And the future is really an imagination. Who knows what the future is going to be? So if you're worried about what's going to happen, you've engaged your imagination. It might not be that way at all. I think it was Mark, someone, I don't know who it was, Mark Twain or someone else, said, I've had a lot of difficulties in my life, most of which never happened. And I've known people who've had like panic attacks. And one of the techniques for working with people with panic attacks that occasionally can work is you ask them just to look around, like you're in a room someplace, and just look around, and is anything here that's threatening? Anything? And they look around, they don't see anything that's of any danger. They realize in the present moment there's no danger at all. So so at least I propose to you, in your study of suffering, how much of your suffering has to do with what's here and now? And if it's not here and now, how real is it? If it's not here and now, then it's being mediated through your thoughts. And what's the reality of a thought compared to the reality of our body here and now, and a room full of people here and now, and a voice speaking here and now, and your thoughts right now. Right now, what's happening now? I think there's a huge qualitative difference between, our thoughts projecting things far away and what's happening here right now. So it's certainly American Buddhists have been accused by other people of having the present moment to be kind of like their God. And sometimes in Buddhism, in kind of Western Buddhism, it seems like that's all it is to finally arrive here and be just really here. And that's all, the be-all and end-all of Buddhism, just to be fully here. At least in the discourse of the Buddha, here is the beginning of the path. To somehow find out how to arrive here, to be here in a very clear way, and have some sense of a commitment or devotion, maybe devotion is a better word, devotion to the importance and value of being fully and completely here. I haven't done it now for a few years, but I used to love looking at old photographs. And really old. The older the better. Old enough so the people in the photographs were dead. That's really, you know. So, 100 years old, or 120, 30 years old, some really old pictures. And why I like looking at it, what I liked most was to look at the faces, the facial expressions, or in the eyes of the people in the photograph. And you'd see this human expressivity of one single person at a particular time. And occasionally you see someone whose eyes kind of sparkled in these photographs, like he was like alive and present, and you know, like they're really here. Sometimes you see they're really tired or dazed or whatever, different kind of expressions. But I really liked a lot the ones who were kind of like bright-eyed. But anything was fine. And the reason I liked looking at it was looking at those eyes and those faces I had this thought. That moment, 100 years ago, 120 years ago, that was their moment to be alive. Each of us are given these moments, certain number of moments, and we're using them up very quickly. We have a certain number of moments to be alive. And that was their moment, so that's precious life. And that kind of reflects, looking at those pictures and those eyes and reflecting that way, the thing that comes rushing at me, or used to come rushing at me, was, and this is my time. To be conscious, to be aware, to be here in a conscious way. This is my time. In that great expanse of time, each of us is given, you know, just a very short time. And it's really great to have, in that short time we're given, to actually be present for it, to be conscious. So the Buddha said, to be, it's basically something like this, a little bit paraphrased, but attention is the path to the deathless. Inattention is the path to death. Those who are attentive never die. Those who are inattentive, it's as if they're already dead. That seems to me a very powerful statement. If you're not paying attention, if you're not conscious, you know, it's almost like you're dead. You know, that wonderful life force of our life is not really happening. And I've known people who spent years in fantasy, years remembering the past, years planning for the future. I wonder if people plan to plan. They must. The way some people are just addicted to planning, they probably just plan to plan also. Tomorrow at 3 o'clock I'll plan for next week. Some people are really good at checking out, going into fantasy, watching television, whatever. So here, the Buddhist path begins here. The path of mindfulness begins here. And here is supposed to be a very special place, a very important place. And I would suggest maybe a safe place to be, or the beginning of safety. And then the four foundations of mindfulness. excuse me. I had a kind of a cold last week. It's all gone now except that Now my lungs are cleaning themselves out. So then it kind of tickles in there. So not so nice for you to have to listen to, so I apologize. So then the four foundations of mindfulness makes a very interesting statement, kind of setting up this practice of paying attention, being mindful. It says the person who's going to be mindful needs to put aside greed and distress concerning the world. So put aside greed and distress concerning the world. And how I understand this statement is, if you want to wake up, if you want to start practicing mindfulness, you have to be able to learn a revolution in the mind. You turn the mind around a certain way. And this is how I'll describe it. Most human minds are, or let's say, for the time being, let's say thought processes, our thinking is usually about something. So like if you think in words, there's a subject, an object, and a verb. And so there's an object for that thinking. So the planning thing, right? So your mind, your thinking is about the future, about the plan. Or if you're remembering, it's about what happened yesterday. Or it's about the fantasy. Or it's about what you want. Or it's about what you don't want. Or it's about, you know, it's about something. It's about what you're afraid of. Thinking is about something. And often it's about things in the world. Or just about something. And what we're asked to do in mindfulness is to begin disengaging ourselves a little bit from a mind which is preoccupied with the world of aboutness. And turn around, in a sense, 180 degrees, from aboutness to isness. So rather than living a life of aboutness, to begin living a life of isness. Can I say that? So to turn around and become present for our, in a sense, our subjective experience. What is that? What's actually being experienced here? What's the experience right now that's happening now? Not what I think about it, not what I want about it, but what's the immediate right now experience that's happening? So the mindfulness practice, in order to practice mindfulness, there has to be some willingness to let the mind decouple itself from the aboutness world, that virtual reality world, so that we can really begin investigating and seeing what's really here. Now that's a huge, you're asking the mind a huge task, because the mind often, you know, just, it's been doing it for decades usually, for at least our people our age, thinking about things, about stuff. And aboutness is the world of kind of constantly negotiating and reorganizing the world for ourselves and fixing things and building up an ego and creating a better self or defending a self or all the selfing that we do. A self is another world of aboutness. If you're trying to make a self or defend a self or fix yourself, in a sense, it can very easily, it's still a world of aboutness, some ideas about you. Treat yourself as an about thing. So this movement of, okay, what is my real experience there? Can I inhabit and live my experience in the kind of direct way that I'm living in the isness of what's going on rather than in the aboutness? So with that as the introduction here, and this turn of the mind, then the Buddha teaches mindfulness of breathing, inhabit your breathing, be present for breath. In mindfulness of the body, inhabit your body, be your body. That's what isness, much a lot of isness is, you know, your physical, felt sense, lived experience of being in a body. You can be centered here. Find yourself here in this body, grounded. And then mindfulness of feelings. Excuse me. And then mindfulness of the mind. Start paying attention to some of the things going on in the mind in the present moment. And then, with that as a foundation, we really can begin, you kind of become familiar with the immediacy of your body, the immediacy of your feelings, the immediacy of your mind. Then you have set a stage for to begin understanding some of the ways in which the processes of the mind, how they operate. The ecology, the ecosystem of the mind, how that ecosystem operates. And so the mindfulness practice then begins to be kind of a naturalist, an ecologist of the mind, studying the ecology of the mind, how it works. And the final ecology, the final kind of process that we're asked to study is studying the Four Noble Truths. And that's a process. So the process of suffering, how suffering happens, the process, the connection, process connection between craving or clinging and suffering. And here's a teaching of Buddhism, I believe, that very simple formulation of kind of core teaching of Buddhism, and that is, if you cling, you will suffer. And if you let go of that clinging, the suffering will stop. If you cling, you will suffer. If you let go of that clinging, that suffering will stop. So there's Four Noble Truths. So this huge foundation that's been created, the stability, being here, studying what's here, seeing what's here, having the mind centered and calm, and really knowing yourself, then to look and see, where is it that the mind is holding? Where is it clinging? And the amazing thing about the mind is that the clinging can be very subtle. And in fact, some of the most tenacious and most powerful and influential clingings that we have in our minds are usually out of sight in ordinary consciousness, walking around, just being. So there has to be some ability to really get in there, kind of under the surface chatter of the mind, to see really deep down at where there's holding, where there's a suffering. Suffering maybe that we don't even know we have. Is that depressing? You know, you thought you want Buddhism to help you address the suffering you know about. And then, you know, you do this practice and you discover you have suffering you didn't even know about. But this the idea is this, the suffering, that the kind of the deep clinging is the wellspring for the suffering that we can see, the clinging we can see. So develop yourself, get calm, stable, concentrated, so you can start seeing very deep, very deep, deep. And it's so deep that I like to say that consciousness itself is a form of clinging. And the interesting thing is, what happens when consciousness lets go of itself? And why would you want that? One of the reasons you want that is because you see that there's suffering there. I mean, it's very, very refined. I mean, it's not like anything like, you know, you got a parking ticket or something. I mean, it's really, you know, it's you have to have a mind that's very very happy to see it. You have to, you know, tremendous stability in the mind. So suffering there, so it's nice to be free of suffering. And the task in Buddhism is to somehow learn to be, discover how to be free of all the suffering. And so if consciousness itself is a kind of suffering, kind of strange, subtle kind of suffering, and so you let go of that too, then what? It's kind of inconceivable, isn't it? It's unthinkable. That which you can't think about. Or it's unthinkable, it's inconceivable, that place that has no, there's no thinking going on. However, it's one of the greatest peace, greatest form of peace, of that freedom, that release of consciousness itself, is sometimes in Buddhism called the great happiness. So the last thing I'll say is a rewording of the Four Noble Truths. I get criticized for this sometimes, rewording it this way, because people think it becomes like Buddhism light, or it becomes kind of superficial. So the First Noble Truth is the truth of suffering. The Second Noble Truth is the truth of the origins, the cause of suffering. And the Third Noble Truth is happiness. And the Fourth Noble Truth are the conditions that we put in place to let that happiness bloom in our lives. So each step along the way of letting go of clinging, letting go of suffering, the goal is to make us happy. To be happy. So that's very important to realize, so that we don't get... sometimes Buddhists get a little bit too serious and glum about all this. It's supposed to be, all this is supposed to make you happy in a very deep way. So, the first talk of the year in the Four Noble Truths. I don't know how many of you are ready for this profound teaching. So maybe it's something you can work on over the course of the year, is make yourself ready for next year's talk. Anyway, thank you very much, and I wish you all Happy New Year, and